Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. A lot of time is spent waiting for your kettle to boil. This is immediate hot water, but not only can you use it for your brews, you can use it to make your pastas, your rice, your vegetables, all sorts of things. It's a fantastic invention. I love it. Great gadget for the kitchen. If you can afford one, I would definitely recommend it. Go to cooker.co.uk, Q-U-O-O-K-E-R.co.uk. Today's hour, I'm curious about the universe and what is the point of life? It's just sort of a small question we're dealing with today. Today's podcast conversation with physicist and cosmologist Paul Davis about the universe. Paul has written a book called What's Eating the Universe, where he answers the questions, things like what was before the Big Bang? Why is the sky dark at night? Is there alien life? Hopefully today we'll find out what the meaning of life is too. Let's meet him. Here's Paul Davis, all the way from Arizona. Hi, Paul. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You're in Arizona. How did you end up in Arizona?
Oh, well, that's a bit of a long story. I grew up in London. I was a student at London University. And then my last position, academic position in the UK, was at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne for 10 years. And then I decided to move to Australia, to the University of Adelaide, for 16 years in total in Australia. And then I decided that a move to the United States was probably a good thing professionally, because my interests have become very broad. They started out in theoretical physics, but grew to encompass what we now call astrobiology. And I wanted to go to a big university that would accommodate all of these interests. And Arizona State University in Phoenix is an incredible institution. It's the biggest in the United States and extremely diverse, but absolutely committed to interdisciplinary research for people like me with broad interests. And they've been very, very supportive. So it's a terrific institution.
So you have to excuse my ignorance. Your day job is lecturing and researching.
Yes, the lecturing, I have to say, not very much. I happen to be giving a lecture today and one tomorrow, but I do very little in the way of teaching. It's primarily a research position, and I run a research unit called the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science. And we're dedicated to drilling down into those deep questions of existence, things like, how did the universe begin, and the origin of life, and time travel, and space travel, and the destiny of mankind, and, you know, all of those sorts of big questions. Those are the things we concentrate on in our research. I'm also very active in the origin of cancer, a big cancer research program here at Arizona State University. And I was asked to become involved in that about 15 years ago. And so about half of my work is in theoretical physics and half in the nature and origin of life, including cancer.
How do those two correlate? How are they connected?
Yes, deep down, it all makes sense to me. But the cancer research was totally out of the blue. It occurred because the deputy director of the National Cancer Institute simply phoned me out of the blue back around about 2007. And she said, roughly, we're spending $5 billion of taxpayer money per year on cancer research, and we're not making a lot of progress. So can physicists help, you see? And who was I to say no? But I said, I know nothing about cancer. And she said, well, that doesn't matter. I'd like you to help us start a national program of bringing physical scientists and cancer biologists together, because we need some radically new thinking. And there began an amazing program funded to the tune of 30-something million dollars a year of precisely this, of bringing in physical scientists. And I ran the center for this at Arizona State University and developed a whole new theory of cancer. And when I finish speaking to you, I'm going to be speaking on that very topic at a Zoom conference with this same woman who recruited me all those years ago, and a group of forward-thinking cancer researchers that think we need something fundamentally new.
Well, I wasn't very good at school. You must excuse me on this. So my sciences weren't amazing, if the truth be known. How would you look at cancer different from biologists?
Well, the essence of the ideas that we've developed are to look at cancer as a biological phenomenon. You see, most people working in cancer research just think, well, it's a disease we want to get rid of. And they don't think, well, why does it exist in the first place? The thing that most struck me when I got into this is that cancer isn't restricted to human beings. It's found pretty much in all animals and birds and insects and even plants and fungi. In other words, it's got very deep evolutionary roots. Anything you find across the tree of life goes back to the convergence of those branches of the tree. I'm talking about over a billion years. So cancer is something deeply embedded in the nature of complex life, multicelled life. So the basis of our idea is that when cancer develops, it's like a default. It's going back to an ancestral state. I compare it a little bit to like safe mode on a computer. Computer suffers an insult and it defaults back to its core functionality that's sort of built in at the basic stage. So that's what cancer is like. And the reason it's so hard to combat is because if cells give up their core functionality, they're dead. And so they protect that most fiercely. And they've had billions of years to learn how to deal with insults to that core functionality. So looking at it as like a reversion or a throwback to an earlier state of life has been very fruitful because you can date genes. There are people, there's a frightening term called phylostratigraphy. And these are people who, if you give me your favorite cancer gene, they can look up how old it is. And so we made predictions about which particular cancer genes would become active, switched on, if you like, at which stage of development. And these things are checking out very nicely. There are people around the world working on these ideas. And so far, it's looking really very good. So it's a whole new way of thinking about cancer. And the other aspect that we have found, which I think is really fascinating, is that I think everybody knows cancer is associated with lots of mutations in the genes. And the standard theory is that the mutations are causing the cancer. And we say, no, it's not really that at all. Some might trigger it, but most of that damage is actually self-inflicted. The cell is deliberately being sloppy in the way it's repairing DNA damage. And when you look at the genes, the cancer genes that are older than about 900 million years, you find that these are the same genes that bacteria use to mutate their way out of trouble. If you starve bacteria, they think, what are we going to do? Got a whole lot of bacteria in a colony. And they start turning up their mutation rate. They can deliberately tune it to find solutions to the problem. So it's a very ancient defense mechanism. And it's the same genes in cancer. So it's another great example of a default back to a sort of ancient mode of solving problems.
So we've evolved, but the mutation hasn't evolved or is come with us on the journey.
The same genes. And it's like building a house. You know, you've got the foundations and then you've got all of the fancy stuff you put on that. You can't pull the foundations out. They're still there, but you may conceal them with the later embellishments. But what happens in cancer is those later embellishments get discarded or jettisoned or they're not serviced properly and everything reverts back to the core foundation. So we've still got those genes. We're carrying genes in us that are 3.5 billion years old.
How many years have you been working in science now?
Since I was born, I usually tell people I was born a physicist. I grew up in North London, in Hampstead Garden suburb. I can remember my father taking me through one of the woods there One evening, coming back from the cinema and pointing out things in the sky, and I was, you know, hooked really from a very early age, you know, 5 or 6, something like that. But the other story I like to tell, which is a little bit of embellishment but true, is that my real interest in astronomy came when Margaret Thatcher gave me a star atlas at the age of 16, which she did. She was the MP for Finchley, where I went to school, and she came for speech day and handed out the prizes. So this was my O-level prize. And really by that stage, I knew that I wanted to not only be a scientist, but to work in astrophysics and cosmology. So it goes way back. I wasn't really interested in much else.
I suppose the reason why I asked the question is I can't quite put my finger on whether science is moving faster now, and you would know because you've had a experience of it over many years. But whether it's moving fast now or we're just privy to more information, we've got the internet. And so, you know, every time I switch my computer on because I follow certain things, it sends me details of another scientist telling me this is how the universe looks to them or something. What is it? Is it a combination of both or is science moving faster?
Well, it is a combination of both. You can tell it's moving faster just on the basis of the number of scientists who are employed. It's grown enormously, and I think it's recognised that science is the engine of technology, which is the engine of economic growth. And so it's astonishing. For example, when I was at school in Finchley, I asked one of the well, the careers master he was, who was a scientist, that I thought I might want to be an astronomer. And he looked a bit sceptical and he said, well, I don't know about that. Don't suppose you make much money from astronomy. And I said, well, how do I go about it? And, it, you know, in those days, astronomy was done by the Admiralty.
Right.
It was a branch, you know, it was regarded as navigation. And it was really a tiny little group of people. And you became a civil servant. Well, all that changed by the time I got my PhD. It was expanding enormously. And I went to Cambridge as a postdoc, as we call it, postdoctoral research fellow. I went to work with a man called Fred Hoyle, who was a household name in the 50s and 60s. He was a cosmologist, a very outspoken and somewhat irascible fellow. He was also a great science fiction author. Wrote a number of books, and he wrote the TV series A for Andromeda that was shown on BBC television. So he was really quite a character. And I went to work with him, but there were, of course, other young people down the corridor at the Institute of Theoretical Astronomy in Cambridge. And these other young people included Stephen Hawking and Martin Rees, now Lord Rees, the Astronomer Royal, and other people who became world famous scientists. But they were just, other people doing astrophysics and cosmology. It was really history in the making. I can see now, looking back on it, that and I'm now talking about the early 70s, it shows my age, that was really a turning point, not only in the progress of astronomy, well, science in general, but particularly astronomy and cosmology. But it was a time that the public really started to pay more attention to these exciting developments.
Interestingly, Stephen Hawking became such a huge, used the word star around the world. How talented was he?
He was certainly very talented, and every comment about Stephen, you have to understand, is qualified by the terrible physical condition that he was in. And so, in those early days, people thought he would live for no more than a year. And I can remember, well, the story I like to tell is sitting in my office a few doors along from his. As always in Britain, a big event is tea break. the tea used to be brought on a trolley into a little area like a small library. And I'd always know it was time for tea when Stephen would propel his wheelchair backwards. He could do it himself in those days. It wasn't motorized. And so we would often chat over tea, but it was very hard to understand him. You see, he would talk in this very slurred way. He'd say, hi, Stephen, what did you do over the weekend or something? And but there were always students or postdocs around who would translate. Stephen says this, Stephen says that. And so it was possible to talk to him. But what it wasn't possible was for him to sort of leap up, take a piece of chalk and start writing equations on a blackboard. Everything had to be done in this labored way. And he very heroically used to say that this helped him think more clearly, because the rest of us got lost in a blizzard of equations, and often we couldn't see the wood for the trees. Whereas he was, because he couldn't do that, he was able to sort of think very incisively about, well, how do we expect this to work, and what would we expect the result to be, without actually having to solve the equations. And so it's an open question. Had he been able-bodied throughout his career, would he have done even greater things? Or was his physical condition the secret of his success? I don't know the answer to that. He certainly was a leading figure in theoretical physics. There's a list of about a dozen amazing theoretical physicists in the 20th and 21st centuries. He would be in that top dozen, but you could argue for a long time, you know, what position he would be in that dozen.
When I was talking, I love your book, by the way. What I like about it is I don't understand everything in it. I've got to admit, Paul, and sometimes I've read things three or four times and thought, I'm giving up. But I do love it because you have made it basic enough for me to understand most of the concepts in there. What was interesting, I was speaking to a friend last night and I said, I'm interviewing you. And you know, I said what you did and you'd written this book and everything. And the immediate response was, oh, can you find out what my purpose is in life? This meaning of life, and what occurred to me was from that. I mean, it's such a ridiculous thing to ask, but what occurred to me was, with the demise of religion, really amongst a lot of Westerners, the new religion has become the universe, and people often are quoting the universe has sent me, or my purpose in the universe, and it's also made me think. I suppose. With religion, we were the center of the universe, and now we just feel we're these annoying things which have come along to destroy the universe or destroy our planet, at least. And we sort of don't like ourselves at the moment. We feel we don't fit into the universe. We've started looking out a lot further. It must, in your time, you know, since, let's say, from the early 70s, you must have felt you've got much more. You're like a priest in a way, aren't you? There are people constantly asking you guys and Stephen Hawking, what is it? Why are we here? You've now got the answers, not the local vicar.
I've been very closely involved with this interplay between science and religion my entire career. Harking back again to my youth, these early days with the Star Atlas and so on, I used to go to a church youth club at St. Jude's in Hampstead Garden suburb, largely just to meet girls, I have to say. But I was always sort of fascinated by, well, what is all this stuff about God and how does it actually work? And I was, like a lot of young people, baffled by free will. You know, if my brain's made of atoms, well, atoms are going to do what atoms have got to do. And how do I have freedom? Discussing all this with this poor fellow, the curate, at the church used to sort of come along for discussions, and it was mainly about, you know, how important it was for the girls to not get pregnant and that type of thing. But from time to time, we would get into discussions of the meaning of life and the universe and whatnot, and I found the answers to be very unsatisfactory, and I decided, well, only theoretical physics is going to sort me out. And so I sort of abandoned any formal religion at that stage. But if you work on things like how did the universe come to exist and what is life and how will the universe end, inevitably these are questions that for centuries have been part of religion. And so you're asking the same questions, but coming at it from a different point of view. Now, I belong to a group of scientists who are happy to sit down with bishops and theologians and have productive conversation. For me, the science comes first. If the science shows that there is something sort of bigger, that by that I mean if if human beings are embedded in a universe that is a sort of grand scheme of things, it may, I'm not talking about an agent, a god, or anything that created the universe in the standard sense. I'm talking about something a bit more abstract. But if we're part of that bigger scheme, I think that does give people comfort. And over the years, I've been to many meetings in the Vatican, for example. I met Pope John Paul II a couple of times. I did a couple of public debates with the Dalai Lama. Many conversations with bishops and theologians. I just gave a lecture in Coventry Cathedral about 3 weeks ago on this theme. And I'm one of these people who I'm not committed to any point of view. I'm not conventionally religious, but I understand the deep need for you and I and our fellow citizens to somehow position their lives in something bigger. They don't want just the daily round, that's it. They like to feel they're part of some bigger thing. And that's my natural constituency. And so I think I write for them and I lecture for them and I'm looking for answers just as they are.
But you believe we're part of something bigger?
Part of something big, but that doesn't mean, you know, we're created by a super being who was sitting around before the universe and pushed a button and made the Big Bang go bang. I think when you can't be a scientist, this is a critical point, you can't be a scientist without believing that the universe is ordered in a rational way. And furthermore, it's got to be at least in part intelligible to us. You wouldn't embark on trying to figure out, well, what is matter made of if you thought, well, we're not going to understand the answer when we get it. So it's predicated on that idea that there's a rational, intelligible order in nature. And so far, that has borne fruit. That's what we find. And the deeper we dig, the more it seems to make sense. And so it's not that the universe is a sort of ragbag of odds and ends sort of thrown together in an arbitrary way. It's all part of a scheme that is underpinned, and you'll know this from reading the book, underpinned by mathematical relationships, which you don't just see in daily life. When Newton saw the apple fall, he saw a falling apple. But he also, in his mind, could see a set of what we would now call differential equations connecting the motion of the apple to the motion of the moon. Those sorts of deep mathematical connections, which are encrypted, this isn't mathematics that is just adding numbers. This is deep encryption. It's like a code, a cosmic code, that describes how the universe behaves. And you don't see it from daily life. You need this weird thing we call science with writing equations on blackboards and doing strange things to matter in laboratories. You need that to unearth this hidden subtext in nature. And so I think this is a very profound way of looking at things.
But 14 billion years ago, the Big Bang happened. Actually, no, the Big Bang I read in your book, it happened in 1949, didn't it? That's when it was invented,
the Big Bang. That's when the term was coined by the said Fred Hoyle. We were talking about him, and he never believed it, you see. And so he was on a BBC radio program, and he said, oh, well, you know, some people think the universe began all in one go in a sort of Big Bang. Because he knew the universe was expanding, but he thought that instead of everything being created in one go back in nearly 14 billion years ago, that it would be continually created, trickle into the universe, particle by particle, so that overall there was a steady state. There was no beginning and no end. And that idea got ditched in the late 1960s with the discovery of the afterglow from the Big Bang, the fading radiation from the very hot early stage. It bathes the whole universe and was detected in the mid-60s. And there's no way of explaining that nicely within this steady state idea. You have to have a hot origin. And now that radiation is studied, data mined, to use the jargon, to very high precision. And that's where most of our understanding of the early universe and its content today comes from. It's looking at that radiation, which has traveled almost unchanged from the very early stage, from when the universe was a tiny fraction of its present age.
So
look back at the Big Bang.
Right, Paul, this is what I don't understand. So I heard Professor Brian Cox talking about this once. And he said, I could be wrong on this, that we've got a photograph of the Big Bang. And I assume what he meant was that we are looking at, we can sort of look back at the light coming through from all those years ago. Is that right, or am I a million miles away from that?
Yeah, that's pretty much right, except it's no longer what we would call light, it's microwaves. And the reason for that is that the universe, it was light, but the universe has expanded by a factor of about 1,000. And so what's happened is that what started out as just more or less the same as sunlight from that hot early dense phase has been stretched out by the expansion and cooled to microwave temperatures. So it's a microwave hiss. It was first discovered in New Jersey by engineers working on satellite communications. They were getting an annoying hiss in their equipment. And that hiss is the song of the Big Bang. And when you map that across the sky, you get a picture, which there's a rather grainy black and white version of it in my book, of sort of blobs across within that. These blobs represent slightly hotter and cooler regions. And that's something that I inadvertently explained before it was mapped. Back in the 1970s, I was a lecturer at King's College in London. I had a student called Tim Bunch. And the one thing with students is they need to get their PhD. And so you don't get that by working on some intractable problem. And so I found something for Tim to work on. It was looking at quantum effects in an expanding universe, but not just any old expanding universe. We picked one that was particularly simple. It's one that doubles in size in a fixed time. That's called an exponential expansion. That's a technical term, but it's a simple idea. You know, it doubles and it doubles and it doubles. And it turns out that the equations we were interested in could be solved exactly in such a universe. And so we looked at that and we published those results in the 70s. I never thought anybody would ever use it. I thought this was just, you know, Tim's got his PhD, that's fine, good solid piece of work. Never thought it would have application. And only a few years later, suddenly this was really important because the favored explanation now of basically what caused the Big Bang is something called inflation. And the idea is that back in the first split second, the universe leapt in size by an enormous factor. It expanded exponentially. It did exactly this phase that we looked at. And these quantum effects, if our listeners know anything at all about quantum physics, they probably know the word uncertainty, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. What this means in quantum physics, which applies to little things like atoms and molecules, everything you want to measure is subject to uncertainty or fluctuations or indeterminism. And this was true of the universe when it was very small. And so these quantum fluctuations, which are normally restricted to atomic dimensions, got sort of scaled up across the sky. And when you look at this radiation, this fading afterglow of the Big Bang, you are seeing these subatomic quantum effects writ large and frozen in the sky. And the work that Tim and I did precisely explains those fluctuations. And so that's... as I say, it's how science works. You do a bit of theory and then you find, well, sure enough, it fits the universe. And I should say, I feel proud of this because without those fluctuations, we wouldn't be having this conversation now because they represent tiny, overdense regions of the universe that eventually became galaxies, the clusters of galaxies and then stars and planets and on this planet, people. And without those primordial fluctuations embedded in the structure of the universe, there would be no planets and no life.
When you say it starts off small, how small is small?
You have to decide how big a region we're talking about now. And there are many, many of these comparisons. So you can say, well, let's take the volume of space that we can now see, which is about 14 billion light years across, and run the great cosmic movie backwards, and then that gets smaller and smaller and smaller, that region. But it's a little bit ambiguous because the finite speed of light, we can't see more than 14 billion light years out into space because it hasn't had the universe is only 14 billion years old, and so that's the distance that light can have travelled. So you have to think, well, at 1 second after the Big Bang, how far could you see then? Well, only a light second, and at a microsecond, a light microsecond. So it's not a very good question to ask. A much better question to ask is, what was the temperature, or how energetic, or what was the density of matter? And what I like to say, because it sounds pretty dramatic, is there's a particle accelerator in Switzerland called the Large Hadron Collider. It's yep. famous for making something called the Higgs boson. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous thing, 20-something kilometers in circumference, a tube under the ground, and it hurls protons in counter-rotating beams at very close to the speed of light, and then they smash together. Well, those collisions recreate fleetingly, of course, the conditions that would have prevailed in the Big Bang at about a trillionth of a second after the beginning, when the temperatures were billions and billions of degrees, so enormous temperatures. Don't remember the exact number off the top of my head now. But everything that all the contents of the universe were squashed down into a very small volume. And the further back you go, the more they're squashed. And one of the big problems that Hawking was working on when I went to Cambridge back in 1970 is everything squashed down to literally a zero size? Could we imagine the entire contents of the universe being at a single point of space called a singularity? And Hawking, who was in those days working very closely with Roger Penrose, who got the Nobel Prize for Physics last year, had produced a number of mathematical theorems about whether and on what circumstances these singularities would occur. And the prevailing view was that the beginning of the universe was a singularity and there was no space-time before it. So when people would ask the question, what happened before the Big Bang? The answer was nothing, because there was no space and no time. Time itself began with the Big Bang, if there was a singularity at the beginning. So these were sort of weighty topics. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, for many years I would go to dinner parties, you know, and if I was intemperate enough to mention I worked in cosmology, I'd end up being grilled on these sorts of topics. And people always got angry when they asked the question, well, what happened before the Big Bang? And I'd say, well, nothing, because time itself began with the Big Bang. And they'd say, well, what does that mean? That doesn't make any sense. And, it must mean something and all the rest of it. And then I point out that St. Augustine of Hippo in the 5th century already came up with that conclusion. He said the world was made with time and not in time. And he made that for theological reasons. So we're back to this, fascinating debate. Because, you see, Christians don't like the idea of a God who sits there forever and ever, if God is eternal, and sits there doing nothing, and then for some arbitrary motion makes a universe. That's not a very edifying view of a deity. And so one way of getting around that, dates back at least to Augustine, is to say, well, God made time and space, as well as matter and energy. God is outside of time altogether, transcends space and time, sort of abstract idea of God, but not sitting around forever and ever. And that was the view. The pendulum has swung in recent years, and the current belief among most of my colleagues is that the Big Bang wasn't the ultimate origin of all physical things. It was the beginning of our universe, but our universe is one among many, probably an infinite number of universes, sometimes called bubble universes. And these bubbles are sort of going off all over the place, like when you, uncork a fizzy drink and the bubbles appear. And so the idea is that what we call the universe is really just our universe, and the Big Bang is just one bang.
Just before we get onto multiple universes, because I think that's a good thing to get onto, and you discuss that in your book. The thing I can't get my head around, I suppose, really is if I'm in my room now, the room is full. I mean, it's full of material things, but also the air is full, right? It's full of oxygen and everything in the planet under the atmosphere is full. Have I? if we go out into the universe, into space, sorry, and into all around all the, I imagine that's all full as well. There isn't any empty spaces unless we're talking about a black hole. Is that empty? So if everything's full, how is there more stuff being created when it expands? That's probably a really stupid question. I apologize for that, Paul, but I just can't get my head around how more stuff is being created constantly.
You're referring to Fred Hoyle's now discredited steady state theory, who wanted continual creation. But it's true that even in the standard Big Bang theory, there are things being created at a fairly low rate. But first of all, this notion of space is an important one because, you know, just think that even in the room you're sitting in, there are air molecules, that's true, but there is space between the molecules. And so most of your body is actually empty space.
Right.
It's sort of held together by the interatomic forces. But then you go up above the atmosphere and the number of atoms per liter or however you want to mention it is exceedingly tiny, which is why you don't have to worry about spacecraft going to Mars, you know, slowing down and stopping. But then the point is that as the universe expands, there's more and more space appears. So the expansion of the universe is really best thought of not as a whole bunch of galaxies flying apart from a common center, but every galaxy moving away from every other because the space between them is swelling or stretching. And the idea that space can expand is a hard one for people to wrap their heads around, but it goes back to Einstein's general theory of relativity in 1915, so this is over 100 years old. And we know space is elastic. For example, one of the big discoveries of the last decade has been gravitational waves. And these things are just ripples or vibrations in space itself. So space can shudder, and these waves travel out at the speed of light, and they can be detected. So this is a direct example of space being elastic. And it can be twisted as well, and you can observe the twisting of space. Certain types of dense stars rotate around each other, spinning black holes twists the space. You can even measure the twisting of space by the Earth. There was a satellite that did this some years ago called Gravity Probe B. Tiny, tiny effect in the case of the Earth. But space itself, you see, is a malleable thing. It's not just like a fixed arena in which the world happens. And so space can expand, and the expanding universe is the expansion of space itself. And so the density of matter falls all the time. But there are particles being created. Think about it. Every time you switch on a light, photons, these are particles of light, are being created. And so in the Large Hadron Collider, protons collide with each other, and they create particles. Cosmic rays hit the upper atmosphere, they create huge showers of particles you can detect down on the ground.
So, Paul, every time I turn the light on, I'm like God, I'm creating something. It's a lovely thought. Let's get on to, we'll go into a duplicate universe in a minute, but let's first of all talk about life outside Earth. And interestingly, in your book, because you do discuss it, I think things swing, don't they, backwards and forwards, whether people do believe it or not. And there's just one sentence which I thought was really good. You say the answer could lie anywhere on a spectrum from complete fluke to almost inevitable. And I just thought that was a really, it got me thinking. In my mind, it feels like it is inevitable, but often people want it to be a complete fluke, that we are this absolute miracle that we've been created. Where are you thinking at the moment? Where are you on that spectrum?
Well, I'm a contrarian sort of person, so I tend to go the opposite way to what my colleagues do. And when I was a student, I was a passionate believer in the existence of extraterrestrial life, or at least I say believer. I wanted it to be true, and it seemed to me no reason to rule it out. And everybody thought that was crazy, that searching for life beyond Earth, you might as well have said you were searching for fairies. It was self-evidently absurd. And the reason is the prevailing view said that, life is so incredibly complex and so specific in its complexity, All life on Earth is the same sort of scheme, that the chances of that happening twice are infinitesimal, and therefore we are alone in the universe. Francis Crick, I think, is somebody who's pretty well known around the world, but in Britain in particular. He was the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, and he said in the early 1970s, life seems almost a miracle, so many of the conditions for it to get going. And of course, some religious people wanted it to be a real miracle. That's exactly what they wanted. My view is no, life is going to be widespread. It'll be easy to make. And then fast forward about 20 years, and the scientific community was suddenly saying exactly that. Oh, well, the universe will be teeming with life. Stephen Hawking, for example, expressed that opinion. I thought to myself, well, hold on. You know, what happened to all the derision I received back in the 70s when I thought this was the case? And so I became more and more skeptical. But the reason I became skeptical is not just to be awkward, but because I have been working in my research along with colleagues, and I must mention my very close colleague, Sarah Walker, in the Beyond Center at Arizona State University. So she and I have collaborated on theoretical models of life's origin. You know, how does a mishmash of chemicals turn itself into a living thing? It seems incredible that this could happen. What does it take? And how likely is that? And she and I differ somewhat on how likely that seems to be. But I've come to the point of view that it could be very unlikely. It could be a very fluky thing, a dream run of chemical reactions. You might need 10 or 100 or something all lined up the right way. What are the chances of that happening more than once? The truth is, we don't know. I'm completely open-minded, but one way to find out is to try and find a second sample of life, a second genesis anywhere in the universe. If we find that life has happened more than once from scratch, then that would make the point that it's not that difficult to get going. But we're actually completely ignorant at this stage of just how likely it is for chemicals to turn into life. Obviously, it happened once. There must be a method. And what the implications are, you know, there's something in it for everybody. If it turns out the universe is teeming with life, for me, that would suggest that we should feel more at home in the universe, that this is a universe that's sort of rigged in favor of life, and therefore very congenial place to find ourselves. And wouldn't that be wonderful and uplifting? Whereas traditional religious people don't want life out there because they want it to be a miracle. And so you can interpret it according to your prejudices.
Interesting. I've spent a lot of time looking at alien stuff online. I love it. I have to keep on reminding myself that none of it's proven, it's not real. But what's interesting, I do find myself being, you know, going down the rabbit holes constantly, looking at UFOs and aliens and the fact they're living in the seas and in their ships and everything. It seems to be a really big thing at the moment. It seems to be very en vogue for people to do that. But the other side, I was saying right at the beginning of this conversation, was that you're like the science is like the new religion. It's also must be frustrating that science is now disbelieved so much, isn't it? Because of the internet, even if we're looking at the pandemics or things, people are going, oh, no, it's not. It's all fake. And is it also frustrating that you lot are now not being believed with your calculations, as well as you know, you're splitting us into some people believing everything you guys are saying, and other people denying what your knowledge you're giving us.
It's not a new phenomenon, particularly in the United States. There's always been a substantial number of people who are sort of religious fundamentalists and simply reject the science. And I have been talking about my productive engagement with religious leaders and communities. But these are people who, not religious extremists, and people who are very open to discussing the science, and that's not a problem. But if you are intractably opposed, if you choose to, you know, believe the Bible rather than believe the results of science, well, there's nothing I can do for such people, because I would somehow be part of a conspiracy to, you know, undermine their beliefs. So I don't talk to them. I don't get involved with those people at all. Now, that's on the religious front. But now we morph into the world where, you know, like the pandemic, for example, that people are suspicious of the science. And so there's always a middle position in which you say, well, we don't divide into two camps. You know, it's absolutely this or absolutely that. You have to, of course, be cautious and question the science. And the essence of science is that it changes. That's the big difference between science and religion. If somebody is deeply religious, no matter what, they won't change their minds. In science, you're supposed to change your mind. You're supposed to gather evidence and think, oh, well, we used to think this, but now looks like it might be that. That's perfectly healthy. That's the power of science. But a lot of people don't understand that. And they think, oh, you know, the scientists disagree about climate change or the pandemic or something. So we don't believe any of them. Well, that's a terrible point of view. Because ultimately, I said it earlier, that science is the engine of technology, which is the engine of economic growth. These same people who reject science are perfectly happy to get on a plane and rely on Newtonian mechanics to safely get them to their destination. I have very little sympathy. But there must be some people, and I feel I can speak to them, who pick up some of these alternative ideas and are thinking, they might think, well, I don't know much science, I'm not in a good position to judge. But if those people are simply prepared to listen to scientists who might explain, well, why this is so or why that doesn't appear to work the way you think, that's fine. We have a job to persuade them, because not everybody is trained as a scientist.
I always remember the story, and I can't think of his name now, of the surgeon who reckoned surgeons should wash their hands because there might be bugs on them and germs, and his industry laughed at him. He ended up in a mental home, I think, because he was laughed, and surgeons used to think the more blood on them they had on them, the better it was. So, you know, things do change, and I think that's...
Yes, the germ theory was derided in the early days. People thought, well, how can there be, you know, these little invisible organisms? But of course now we know it's true. But that's the great thing about science: we discover new things, we change our minds.
Okay, let's talk about the two things then that I've been wanting to talk about. Multiple universes, which I can't get my head around at all, but I'm willing to give it a go. And the idea that we might be a simulation, which obviously most of us have heard about it because Elon Musk started talking about it. So because Elon Musk talked about it, we were listening, and he said the closer we get to simulating a universe, the more we realize we are a simulation. Don't quite understand what either means, but I sort of understand being a simulation more than multiple universes, or is it the same thing?
They do connect up, and I've written about that topic too. Earlier on, the simple idea we were talking about, well, maybe the Big Bang is only one bang among many, and then we can think of these sorts of bubbles. You think, well, what's between the bubbles? Well, there would be more space between the bubbles, but the space would be expanding very fast. So mostly the bubbles would be conveyed apart. They, as the bubbles expand, they're conveyed apart faster than they're expanding. So in most models, they wouldn't bump into each other, but you can have models in which they do. And the title of my book, What's Eating the Universe, refers to one such theory, that there's a funny patch in the Southern Hemisphere where the heat radiation from the Big Bang seems to be much cooler than the rest. It's as if a cosmic giant has taken a bite out of the universe. And it's been suggested by the cosmologist Laura Mazzini-Houghton that perhaps that's another bubble universe banging into ours. Sort of an awesome encounter, if you think about it. That's very speculative. But the idea that there isn't just one universe, but maybe an infinity of them, and that this assemblage of multiple universes, often called the multiverse, has no beginning or end. That now is a pretty fashionable view among my colleagues. There's another version of multiple universes that people may have heard about coming out of quantum physics. That says, well, there are sort of parallel realities. And I'll just give you a very simple example. I mentioned that quantum mechanics is associated with uncertainty. I'll give you a concrete example. You fire an electron at an atom and it bounces to the left. And then you do it again under identical conditions. Next time it bounces to the right. Well, quantum physics can tell you the betting odds, you know, is it 50-50, 40-60 or something? It can tell you that, but it can't ever tell you which one it's going to be on any given occasion. And so one way of thinking about that is there are actually two realities, one with a left-moving electron, one with a right-moving electron, and each has observers and each thinks they're in a unique world, but actually they're in parallel worlds. And this parallel universes or parallel realities interpretation of quantum mechanics, again, is very popular. It's probably, probably the explanation of choice among most of my physics colleagues, that we're living not only with all these infinite number of bubbles out there, but the universe is continually splitting into vast numbers of copies of itself. So these ideas have been around for quite some decades and are quite fashionable. But how do we relate that to the computer simulation? Well, the point about infinity is that it immediately leads to some very sort of weird conclusions. And again, I'll give you a simple example. You're shuffling cards. What are the chances that you will shuffle them into exact suit and numerical order? And you'll say, well, it would never happen. Well, you know, never is a very strong word. It would happen eventually if you keep on going. You have to keep going for a very long period of time. But clearly, it could happen. So any configuration of cards that you like to name could happen, and it would happen infinitely often if you kept going forever and ever. And so what that means, if we translate that now into the arrangement of matter in the universe, is that if the universe is infinitely big, or if there are an infinite number of universes, then whatever configuration of matter you have in this universe, it'll happen again somewhere else. There will be duplicates of you and me and the Earth and the whole universe. You have to go a very long way or out to very many of those bubbles before that would happen. But if you believe in infinity, it must happen. So this notion of duplicate beings is really a mathematical inevitability. And you can say, well, that's repugnant on philosophical grounds. So I'll reject the notion of infinity. I don't believe in infinity. And that's a possible position. But now let's leap to simulated universes. And these two topics do connect up. I think everyone's familiar with virtual reality. And I recently had an amazing experience here at Arizona State University working with DreamWorks, the film company, who are developing a teaching package for our students in which they can, you know, put on a visor and walk around some alien world and do experiments on sick alien animals and things like that. And it just is remarkable. You're blundering around in this little room and you think you're Indiana Jones or something. It really was amazing. And so as virtual reality gets better and better, the question is, can we tell it is virtual or simulated reality? How would we know? And again, it's a very old idea. The philosopher Descartes in the 17th century said, well, how can we trust our senses? Supposing a malicious demon is simply feeding images of a world that we think is really out there, but it's all an illusion. And so philosophers have grappled with this idea of what is reality and can we believe our senses for centuries. But now we're getting to the point where technology can literally give us a lifelike world. And fast forward another 100 years, can we imagine that there will be entities who will be conscious and they'll be experiencing things, but they'll be embedded in some sort of super-duper computer system? Not a human being with a visor, but actually literally a conscious computer, or inside a conscious computer, but it would be enormous. It would be much more powerful than now. Maybe something like a quantum computer could do it. And then the question is, how do we know that this world that you and I are now inhabiting, and we're having this conversation, how do we know that it's real and not a simulation in some other system that says, because we don't know what it is, and I'm not saying it's created by other human beings, we would have no idea what would be the simulating system would be. But we have to take that possibility seriously. And here comes the twist and the connection between these two topics, because the point about simulated worlds is that they're far cheaper than real worlds. If you said to me, well, I'll give you a budget, can you make me another Earth or can you make me a virtual reality Earth? I could, the latter would be much cheaper than the former. And so once you have the ability to simulate worlds, then the simulations would soon outnumber the real thing. And so if we imagine that a life and intelligence in a universe somewhere gets to the point where they can start simulating realities, then they're going to proliferate and overtake the real thing. And so then you think, well, are you and I just typical observers? Are we special? We are chosen to be here in this basement reality, this real reality, or are we just arbitrary observers among all of the countless observers that can exist? And if we're just typical observers, then the arithmetic would suggest we're living in a simulation. I don't actually buy this argument, but if you believe there's an infinity of universes, you know, somewhere there's going to be beings who can create simulated worlds. And so among all those many universes out there will be a whole lot of fake universes, and the fake universes will outnumber the real ones by some enormous factor. That's the argument.
It's I love
bizarre
it.
In a way.
I love it. I love it because you get me thinking. But does time have to have an impact on all this? Because you have to have a is there sort of relative time across every single one of these universes? We've got to or do we assume the time's different in all of them? Is there multiple Tims, but we're all in different time zones?
Yes, and now this is a very important question, and it's different for the different things we've been talking about. So, in the case of the many bubbles, each bubble would have, I mean, there would be time in all of them, but the their time and our time would be sort of out of kilter with each other. And a direct comparison of clocks would be impossible anyway. But this is true even within our own universe, that if you and I move differently, our clocks get out of kilter. And you can not only measure that, it's the basis of the GPS navigation system, these slight discrepancies in the nature of time or the passage of time between different clocks moving differently. So all this is sort of thoroughly established, but we sort of assume that there would be time in all these universes. But in a simulated universe, of course, as we know, computers are quick-witted. They run at much faster speed. They can do arithmetic, you know, a trillion times faster than I can. And so if you've got a simulated being in a computer system, then the time that they experience could be completely different from the time that we in the outside world experience. But the word experience implies time. Without time, I don't think we can make any sense of having experiences.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Everything you say sort of relates to time, really. And yet you quite rightly say time doesn't exist the way that I experience it with you, because we're doing an hour here. But if you move around the universe, it's not quite the same. It doesn't experience the same. So all our experiences are based on this thing of time. And yet it's quite confusing, isn't it, time for us? Because it doesn't exist the way that I'm actually experiencing it right now.
Well, I think people feel time in a sort of visceral way because it's the most basic aspect of our experience, the passage of time. Even if you sort of shut the world out, you know, mentally you think things are ticking over. And so any suggestion that there's something funny about time tends to provoke a bit of a reaction. And I get manuscripts from people that simply don't believe that that there can be different experiences of time. They think this is one time and it's the same and it's there and that's it. And the idea that if you go to close to the surface of a black hole, the time becomes sort of infinitely extended. They hate that idea. And they even hate the idea that if you get on a plane and fly from Los Angeles to London and back, that your time is slightly out of kilter with somebody who stays behind. And you can measure that effect, and it's only a few billionths of a second. It's not a Doctor Who type adventure, I'm afraid, but it's a real effect. And people just feel very uncomfortable about it. But I'm afraid that's the way the world is. Not only is space malleable and can be stretched and squeezed and all the other things we've been talking about, but time as well. We can actually do it. We can warp time in the lab and demonstrate it.
Amazing. Paul, we've nearly run out of time. I just want to say at this stage, I've got one more question for you, but well, I've got two questions for you. I just want to say, though, the book is great. I love it. And we didn't even get to why it's Dark at Night. It's worth buying the book, just so you know that. So when you go down the pub with your mates, you can tell them why it's dark out there, which was a great chapter. The two things, what happens when you die in your mind? Anything? I mean, I was going on to say earlier on, the universe is 14 billion years old. And I'm going to live for, I don't know, let's hope I live for 80, 90 years. I'm pretty insignificant in the great scheme of things. So what happens when I die? Is there some like destiny for me, or is it just that's it in your mind? Do you think I just peter out?
Well, I've always struggled with this idea that somehow our consciousness continues after death, because how is that all being organized, you know, and where will we be? Where will we go? And what will we do? And I have a friend who says, well, from what he understands about the afterlife, he doesn't want it, because it's an infinite amount of time with nothing to do. And he thinks that would be incredibly boring. What I usually say, I duck the question. It's that when we're talking about life after death, we're talking about the perpetuation of our conscious experiences beyond death. But we don't actually understand what causes consciousness anyway. We don't understand that well enough to be able to say how much is it literally tied to the human body. It's very hard for me to imagine much beyond death, but then a lot of things we've been talking about are hard to imagine. And there are too many open questions about the nature of the universe and the nature of reality for me to be able to give a strong statement. But I, like you, I sort of feel, well, it's in some ways terrifying, but in some ways disheartening to think, well, you have this sort of 70 years time span on this planet, and then that's it. I would like to believe there's something bigger than that, but I'm not sure. It's just, you know, perpetuation of experience in some heaven.
Okay, well, I asked most of my guests this, so I'm going to ask you, but it's going to be a tough one. What is the meaning of life? Do you manage to find any meaning in life, Paul?
Well, I think if I had a particular answer, I would have told you about this long ago. we were talking earlier about that human life has a significance beyond just the daily round, because we're embedded in this sort of grand cosmic scheme. And I think, you know, nature is wonderful. It's deeply mathematical. And I'm tapping into that through my scientific research. You know, being a physics professor in a university is a great way to live your life. And so I feel, for me, I get meaning out of investigating that deeper nature of reality through science. But that's not a meaning that I can convey very well to non-scientists. And I try with my books and my lectures to show that maybe not meaning in the everyday sense, but something more than, you know, we live and we die and that's it. I hope I've conveyed that in this book.
Oh, Paul, you definitely have. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. It's called What's Eating the Universe and Other Cosmic Questions. And if I can understand most of it, you can as well. So I recommend giving that a read. Thank you so much for joining me today, Paul. It was really lovely. Great conversation.
Yes, I've loved the conversation. Thank you for inviting me.